Welcome to the Independent Media Center Radio Report. This program is collectively produced by Independent Media Center volunteers from around the globe, bringing together stories and ideas that directly affect us all. The IMC Radio Report intends to create media that inspires action and involvement. Stay tuned for news about May Day protests around the world. But first...
On Friday, May 4th, attorneys for radical journalist and death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal released an affidavit from their client in which Mumia, for the first time, definitively denied any role in the 1981 killing of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. Mumia's statement marks the first time he has publicly spoken out about details of what occurred the night Faulkner was killed. Mumia's statement, dated May 3rd, was accompanied by an affidavit that Jamal's brother, William Cook, provided in late April, in which Cook, also for the first time, definitively denied that either he or Mumia played any role in Faulkner's death. Mumia's attorneys also released a 1999 affidavit from Arnold Beverly, who alleges that he played a role in the assassination of Faulkner, shooting Faulkner in the face, which also asserts that Mumia played no role in Faulkner's killing. In his statement, Beverly asserts that Faulkner had been targeted by the mob and crooked Philly cops for execution because he'd, quote, interfered with the graft and payoffs made to allow illegal activity, including prostitution, gambling, and drugs without prosecution, in the Center City area.
Attorneys for Emmanuel Goldstein, the editor and publisher of 2600, The Hacker Quarterly, argued for the reversal of a district court ruling that barred the online magazine from publishing or linking to other sites that publish DECSS, a DVD decryption code. Last year, attorneys for the Motion Picture Association of America successfully sued Goldstein, claiming that the code would help facilitate the pirating of DVD movies. Goldstein's legal team includes attorneys from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Dean of Stanford Law School, Kathleen Sullivan. Sullivan argued that the lower court's interpretation of the law violated Goldstein's constitutional right to publish truthful information. She also maintained that restrictions on publishing the code affects the ability of consumers to use technology that they have already legally purchased. In the case of DVD, she argued, this includes skipping commercials, changing colors, using excerpts, or watching a DVD on an alternative operating system of the consumer's choice, such as Linux. John Gilmore, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
The fundamental issue here is who's responsible for a criminal act. Is it the person who actually infringes the copyright law, or is it the person who sold them a tool that they could use to do that, or they could use for a lawful purpose? It's exactly what Dean Sullivan was saying about crowbars. The movie studio said, these guys are selling a crowbar to break into our house. Well, carpenters have use for crowbars too, and you can't bust somebody on the street because they're carrying a crowbar until you figure out whether they're committing a crime or not.
The court is expected to make a ruling on this case by this summer. For the Independent Media Center in New York City, I'm Craig Heimson.
On May 5th, people in 130 cities worldwide protested the drug war and called for legalization of marijuana. Most of the protests were in North America, but many were also held across Europe, with a few in Asia, Africa, and Australia.
I spoke with Stan Phipps, a college history professor researching labor history, about how the 1st of May became a labor holiday.
Well, it dates back to the 1880s. It was a major movement of the labor movement around the world to get the 8-hour day. There were negotiations and labor demands and scheduled protests and strikes on May 1st. Probably some of the most important were in the United States, and especially in and around Chicago. There was something like 350,000 people striking on May 1st for the 8-hour day in the Chicago area. And there were maybe 100,000, 150,000 people who got the 8-hour day to keep them from striking. So it was one of the high points of the labor upsurge in the period they called the Great Upheaval. And in Chicago, there was a incident at one of the plants, the McCormick Harvester Works, where they made farm equipment. And at the protest, the Chicago police opened fire and killed several of the strikers. A few days later, there was a protest meeting in Chicago to protest the killings and police brutality, as they would call it these days. And the people had a permit for the meeting, and the Chicago mayor visited and said it was a peaceful strike. But the local police captain, a guy by the name of Captain Bonifield, didn't like these folks meeting in his precinct. They were recent immigrants and speaking foreign languages, and some radicals among them. And he sent in a squad of police to break up the meeting, at which point somebody in the crowd, and they're not sure who, tossed a bomb among the police, and the bomb exploded, at which point the police began shooting in all directions, and it was all over. Several people had been killed and many more wounded, at which point the leaders of the 8-hour day movement in Chicago were arrested for conspiracy to cause the riot at the Haymarket Square, as they called it, at which point the 8-hour day movement pretty much died. Chicago, in May 1st, was chosen as Labor Day to commemorate first the uprising and to note the repression of the movement after Haymarket. The United States and Canada are the exceptions to that rule.
That was History Professor Stan Phipps. A new political climate in Bahrain allowed that country's labor force to celebrate May Day this year and express their views. The Bahraini constitution allows the formation of labor unions, but up until now, workers there have not been allowed to form trade unions. On April 30th, 200 unemployed citizens picketed the labor ministry while a delegation representing them held talks with the Minister of Labor. During this meeting, the Amir telephoned the minister and ordered him to pay citizens monthly unemployment benefits for a six-month period. This is very different treatment from a jobless picket staged in June 1994, when the unemployed citizens faced security forces which clamped down and arrested many of them. The new unemployment benefits won't help the more than 60% of the Bahraini workforce who are foreigners.
In Medellin, Colombia, several thousand people attended the annual May Day March called by the country's two main trade unions. The most notable organization presence came from the city's public service workers. A small but lively anarchist presence included members of different collectives. They painted graffiti slogans like, "Down with the paramilitary candidates," a reference to the current presidential candidate, Alvaro Uribe Vélez, who fomented paramilitary groups while governor of the Antioquia region, of which Medellin is the capital. The march was considered relatively calm, partly due to a change in police tactics to less overt aggression. However, there were at least 18 arrests. The reduced participation by non-union groups, such as displaced people, families of the disappeared, neighborhood groups, and militia members, is notable. This partly reflects the explosion of paramilitary activity in the neighborhoods, of which all these groups have been a target. For the same reason, there were fewer cultural activities before and after the march.
Workers at Jeffboat, a major U.S. shipyard owned by Citicorp Group, are staging a wildcat strike against their company and their union. A wildcat strike is a strike not sanctioned by a union, so there is no strike pay or benefits, and workers can be fired for striking. Jeffboat, located on the Ohio River in Jeffersonville, Indiana, is the United States' largest inland shipyard. Workers there started a wildcat strike on April 30th after they rejected, by a 4-to-1 margin, a proposed contract which reportedly set them back on every point and gave their union, Teamsters Local 89, the power to make deals with the company without the members' consent. Union officials had attempted to intimidate the Jeffboat workers into ratifying the contract. After the contract was rejected, Local 89 President Fred Zuckerman announced that he would not sanction a strike. Union officials and office staff were instructed to call workers at home and demand they report to work as usual or face penalties. But on Monday morning, several Jeffboat workers refused to enter the shipyard and started an unsanctioned picket line. Others joined them, and by lunchtime there was a total walkout from the shipyard. 750 workers were fired on Wednesday for not reporting back to work. On Sunday, May 6th, Teamsters President James P. Hoffa met with the strikers. There was a march in front of Local 89 in support of the strikers during this meeting. For more information and to learn how to help the workers, visit the strike's website at www.geocities.com/JeffBoatWildcat.
The Portland, Oregon IMC audio team tells us what happened in that city on May 1st.
In the wake of the WTO, Portland activists have watched the world's trade ministers breaking down hard-earned rights and environmental protections. The disaster of NAFTA to job security and the resulting crisis of treaty-backed polluters brought together labor and environmental activists for the first time. In light of this